First of all, I have nothing to disclose by way of conflict of interest, except probably all the parties involved didn't much approve of the invasion of Iraq. There were four partner universities, University of Washington, Johns Hopkins University, Simon Fraser University, and Mustansiriya University in Baghdad. There have been several previous attempts to measure mortality in Iraq relative to the U.S. invasion in 2003 and the subsequent occupation. There were two of these that involved people who were on our team that did this third study. So the first Robert study in 2004 and the Burnham study in 2006 were sort of precedent studies to ours and involved some of the same techniques. The Iraq Living Conditions study and the opinion research, the Iraq Living Conditions and the Iraq Family Health Survey were sort of Ministry of Health conducted studies that proved to report lower death counts than the other studies. And the opinion research business study was sort of an amazing outlier study conducted by people attempting to do business in Iraq who were curious about this and did their own polling research, not particularly public health approach. So those are the studies. There's also, of course, the Iraq body count, which is a passive surveillance system based on newspaper clippings and counting deaths in that way. They're currently reporting about 125,000 total deaths from the war. If you go to their website, they've adjusted their count slightly upward in relation to the WikiLeaks releases of data, but it's still a passive surveillance count and therefore not particularly good public health science. I think it's important to know that the public perception of what the number of people in Iraq was who died as a result of the invasion and occupation is considered to be about 10,000 people. So surveys of both British and American publics show the majority of people think it's about 10,000. Our team was formed in December of 2010 and includes the four universities I talked about. We were self-funded from internal resources. Johns Hopkins did provide the approximately $125,000 required to fund the data collection effort, which was a door-to-door effort requiring paying enumerators as well as transportation and security expenses. And the project took about 3 years from concept to completion. We had two team meetings in Erbil, one at the start and one after data collection was complete. We had weekly phone calls during the data collection months, and we used the miracle of the internet to trade versions of the paper across our four university-based teams. We asked some critics of the previous papers to critique ours before we submitted them for publication. And we did attempt publication in two other journals before it was accepted by PLOS Medicine and published on October 15th of this year. I think it's fair to say this is the hardest project I've ever worked on as a researcher, not least of which was the institutional review board process involved, which at my university was entirely focused on the rights of the people being surveyed with really no interest in the health or protection of the people doing the surveying. So the most contentious issue was about whether the surveyors had to reveal that they were being supported by American universities, which our IRB wanted them to do. And we finally resolved that in our favor, but not without a great deal of discussion and difficulty. So we used two methods. The previous two studies in this series used strictly the standard household survey. In that one, the head of household is asked about the births and deaths of household members since 2001. So we have a pre-war and a post-war data collection period. And the other questionnaire was administered to all the adults in the household asking about the alive or dead status of siblings of these adults, and if a person is dead, what they died of. So these are the two surveys. So for the household survey, we were able to collect data for about 10,500 people. Household sizes are big in Iraq. And for the sibling survey, we collected data about 25,000 people. And the way these studies go is that we're trying to calculate excess mortality above what the country would have experienced had there been no war. So we're creating sort of a counterfactual thing. And so we take the death rate for before the war and multiply it times the population figure, another troublesome little item, and then calculate the death rate for the period after the war times the population, do a subtraction, and that is excess deaths. I want to tell you a little bit about how we selected our sample, because it was an innovative approach and contributed, I think, a great deal to the advancement of our methods here. So we used Google Earth population-weighted maps and laid a grid over the country, and then with population-weighted probability selected a large territory, a cluster, and then within that we overlaid an even finer grid and selected a neighborhood. And then within that, we selected the largest rooftop as a start place. And we've written a whole paper about the method, if you want to go read about that. It's kind of cool, and I think allowed us to correct for some of the critiques on previous papers. So this is us practicing finding the start household. So the enumerators are given a map with an aerial photograph of the start household, and then they have to go find it. So we practiced that. Erbil's an interesting place if you haven't been here. So the results. Our household deaths for the war period totaled 1.3 million. Those were just overall deaths, not necessarily war-related. I'm not sure I mentioned, but the sample size was 2,000 households. So we visited 100 neighborhoods and surveyed 20 households in each neighborhood. And we generated a total war-related death count of about 405,000 people, a number we knew was an undercount because many of the families by the time we were visiting in 2011 had, of course, migrated away from Iraq if they had experienced death in their household. So we did an attempt to adjust that number, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. Our sibling survey was administered to every adult in the household. Like I said, it told us about 25,000 people. And so for that, we counted about 381,000 deaths, half of which were war-related. And the interesting thing about this data, which we haven't yet mined particularly well, is that we can track deaths going back to previous wars because siblings died between 1960 and the present day, and we can map the shocks over time. We did by sex. Obviously, crude death rates during wartime are much harder on men than on women. And we've also mapped the previous study findings in those little plots. And there it is, the sibling survey. So we portrayed this in our paper as a weekly death count. You can see all the there are both direct and indirect deaths related to the war. So when we asked people if there was a death in your household, what did people die of? They told us about direct war-related deaths, that is, people who were shot or blown up. And they also told us about indirect deaths, so they were died of cancer or heart disease or whatever. And so the excess mortality is in the pink, nonviolent deaths, and the excess mortality violent deaths are in the red. And you can see sort of the peak of the war there, 2005 to 2006. You know, about half the deaths in Iraq were attributable to the war. Here is the adult deaths. We still have no methods to extrapolate from adult deaths, that is that sibling survey, to the nation as a whole, but you can see for adults, this is, you know, even more than half of deaths were attributable to the war at the midpoint. For our migration adjustment, we estimated that 2 million people had left the country as pushed out as refugees. Divided by household size, we estimated the number of households. Somebody had done a survey in Syria of Iraqi refugees there and learned that 15% reported a household death related to the war. So we did a little multiplication and came up with this figure that we added to our count. We have, you know, it's an estimate. It's probably a low estimate. We certainly know there were probably more than 2 million refugees, but there it is. It's the best we could do. This is our team meeting in Erbil. I just wanted to show you this kind of cool map that we put in our study. It maps the WikiLeaks data for mortality in Baghdad. Turns out, while the U.S. military said they weren't doing body counts, they actually did keep some track. And we mapped the clusters that we visited over this map just to see, did the clusters we pick, were they particularly more violent or less violent than this WikiLeaks data might show them to be? And it turned out there wasn't any particular pattern to that. But it was one of our hypotheses around why our death counts were lower than we expected them to be. You know, we're fairly clear that the 500,000 rough estimate that we have of deaths in Iraq is lower than maybe we anticipated or that people might have expected, especially given that the previous Burnham study was at about 655,000. You know, we attributed that undercount to three things, sampling error, non-sampling error, which is just recall or people unwilling to tell us things. And when it's been that many years since the war began, there were probably lots of reasons for people not to tell us things. So that's our paper. You can find it online. This is some public street art in Erbil. I don't know if you can see it. Two men in soldier hats choking each other. So I just like to remind us that as public health workers, we're against polio, and we're against cancer, and we're against car crashes and tobacco smoke. And more we're standing up to say war is a significant cause of death and morbidity, and it's time to be against it.
And because our presenters are geniuses at time management, we actually have time for questions. Are there any questions for anyone on the panel? Sir.
And please take your questions.
Yeah.
So the question was about the difference in the, actually prevalence that I found, not rates, but of violence in my population compared to some of the comparable data sources. And also a question about self-report of violence. And so one thing is that this is not, the other studies are, several of them only look at Iraq veterans, which is a different population than all service members or all veterans. I think the experiences in Iraq were not representative of all deployment experiences. So our level of PTSD was actually quite a bit lower than a lot of the other surveys. So I think that given the strong association between PTSD and anger and violence problems, that's probably a big contributor. We also had a contingent of folks who hadn't yet deployed because they were current service members, so they had recently they'd recently joined. And so that, again, drives down the prevalence because that drives down the base population. And so if we had information on rates, they probably would be more comparable because they'd be including the amount of time that someone might be at risk. But because these are prevalence, we have a different kind of picture. I do think it's also the case that the experiences of reserve service members compared to active duty are different. But actually, there's a lot more opportunities for trauma in certain contexts for reservists because of a lot of the stigma that they experience and mistreatment by active duty personnel because of their reserve status. So it's yet to be untangled, but I think those differences are partly to explain. This is actually the only study I know of with current service members, so I'd love to see some more studies with current service members to know how similar or different this particular study population is. But it is nationally representative, and it was, you know, a national random sample. Oh, self-report. So there are a few different studies that have looked at both measures using self-report, using other family member report, and also then using police records. And self-report isn't actually that different in those particular contexts. So we had no trouble getting self-reported problems with anger. Over about half of all the participants reported having problems with anger. I don't think the way that those questions were phrased, it was that much farther of a leap for them to report problems with violence if they were indeed experiencing those problems. So I there might be a little bit of self-report bias, but I think it would be not substantial enough to create that difference in magnitude between what we saw in this population compared to other populations. No. No, it's the PIs are ones at Columbia and the others at the Uniformed Services University, but it was not, it was DOD funding, but not at all. It was not through DOD. We got the roster through the Defense Manpower Data Center, but it was not VA, not DOD, but it was a CADI, the computer assisted interviews. So they were speaking. It was not a paper survey that they could fill out anonymously. They were linked data, but it was. Not linked in terms of going back to their command or anything.
Sir?
I think the question, though, for you, Dr. Cruz, is how do we reduce stigma among current service members and veterans of seeking help in violence prevention?
The question is, how do we reduce stigma among current service members and veterans about seeking help?
Well, you know, in the broader stigma literature, there are two forms, the internal and the external. The question, I think the question posed, there was a question in the medical care section presentation that we gave yesterday around the issues related to external discrimination, that being issues within the military that somehow cause problems in individuals accessing care. And I think there was an interesting answer to that question, was a kind of an end around the whole discrimination issue, rather than directly facing it, was to externally impose regulations against it, so that the culture changes within the military to improve the accessibility of services. But I think for particularly for the individuals that we're seeing within the Civilian Medical Resource Network, there's a strong internal stigma issue. The issue of a predicted fear or predicted concern of accessing care is a problem, and some of it being clearly justifiable and some of it not necessarily being so justifiable. And so I think there needs to be more studies looking at teasing the justifiable versus the unjustifiable aspects of the stigma that leads to barriers to accessing care. And then looking at some of the healthcare literature on stereotypic threats. Basically, the idea if I'm discriminated against, I internalize that discrimination, it becomes my self-identity, and therefore I don't do things. And seeing some of the different interventions that are being applied, Kaiser just did a publication, I can't remember the journal, looking at with African Americans improving access for hypertension treatment, and maybe trying to employ those types of interventions might be of use. But I think, firstly, I think there needs to be a connection with these people, a much deeper connection, and to understand better their lives, maybe more ethnographic research to understand their stories, their lives, how they go about trying to work their way through life to maybe find different access points within that lifetime trajectory.
And let me say that access of care can be very, very locale specific. You can be lucky enough to be near a really good VA hospital where people want to go, or you can be unfortunate enough to live either very far away from any facility or near a facility that sucks. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, that's a great question. So this was looking at, I think, around the issue of experiencing trauma, not necessarily PTSD, before the military, and then what happened to them after they joined the military. And one of the avenues of analysis that we're in right now is looking at cumulative traumas, and so not looking at the trauma symptom severity scores and symptomatology, but actually looking at how many traumas a person has experienced. There's some literature that shows that there's kind of the body reaches saturation at a certain point, and additional traumas don't continue to, do damage, let's say, after that, because you've already hit a point. And so We're looking at that. We're also looking at what the kinds of traumas are that they're coming in with, and what kinds are deployment related. So I'm using the term deployment related, not combat related, because some of these deployment traumas are military sexual violence or other things that happen, but they happen during a deployment. I'm in the process of looking, disaggregating and classifying by trauma type, and then looking at pre and post experiences. And if you're interested, in the next time segment in the EPI section just upstairs, I'm giving a presentation that goes into much more of the EPI analyses of that, including looking at gender differences, which are really interesting. I'll just give you the little come on over and see.
We have time for one more question, and it's going to Pat.
I think it's fair to say that the response to our paper from the media was largely positive, receptive, interested, particularly contentious the way it was for poor Les Roberts, our predecessor, who really suffered vicious attacks from people who accused him of falsifying numbers and so on. Gil Burnham had a couple of hypotheses about that. One is, we now all pretty much agree we killed a whole mess of a lot of people. And the second is, Iraq? You know, that was so yesterday. We left there in December and of 2011, so who cares about Iraq really anymore? So those are two responses. I would say, the only national newspaper that picked it up was the LA Times. New York Times didn't do it. Washington Post put it on its blog. Even my own hometown newspaper, the Seattle Times, didn't pick it up. But there was a lot of, you know, if you go to Google News and look for it, you get 8 or 9 pages of, you know, the new media addressing this.
I want to thank everyone for being here. And in conclusion, I want to quote a poster that I've had since 1967. It says, "War is not healthy for children and other living things." Let's end it. Thank you.